Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. I want to tell you about some work in collaboration with Eugenio Bianchi. So my research in the last months and years has been very much focused on the question, what is the physics of a finite region of a quantum space-time? I think this question is interesting for a number of reasons. Probably top amongst these is that any practical real experiment is going to measure a finite region of space-time. So it's very interesting for that reason. But in addition, there's a number of technical tools that are being developed for finite regions. Laurent Friedel's bubbles, the general boundary field theory is also very much focused on finite regions. And in particular, they provide a nice technical tool for avoiding some of the difficulties that you might have in a general covariant theory, namely correlation functions being constant because of general covariance and things like that. So finite regions, I think, are a very promising way to think about issues in quantum gravity. And what I'm excited and hopeful about is that we might learn some things from them, deeper understanding of quantum gravity and maybe even some new physics. So I found this recent paper by Hermann Nicolai very thought-provoking on a couple of different levels. One of the things that he emphasizes is that any good theory of quantum gravity has to explain the fate, the eventual fate of divergences in perturbative quantum gravity. Another thing he emphasizes is the recent results from the LHC. The measured mass of the scalar boson avoids two inconsistencies. It avoids the vacuum instability in the Landau pole of self-couplings. So it's right in this middle region where you're not forced to have new physics. If it was just above where it is or just below, you'd be forced to have new physics at a definite scale. So this leads to the conclusion that our currently understood physics may hold all the way up to the Planck scale. And the other interesting result that he emphasizes is that there's been no signal of supersymmetry at these scales. So I think this emphasizes that we need to continue to develop theories that don't rely as heavily on supersymmetry. And the thing I want to tell you about to sort of start off here is a particularly interesting answer to this question about divergences coming from loop gravity. And it's the oldest answer. It's a very simple answer. It says that they're physically cut off. There's a smallest scale. And so I want to just quickly review a constructive way to come to that conclusion. And that's what I think is so interesting about it. It's completely constructive. So this comes from what I'm calling today the polyhedral program. So associated to a spin network in loop gravity are a set of electric flux vectors. And those flux vectors satisfy a Gauss constraint. And in the semi-classical limit, you can associate these flux vectors are angular momenta because of the gauge SU2 gauge invariance at a node. And you can associate to them a set of vectors. And to the Gauss constraint, a closure relation amongst those vectors. And this closure relation is exactly what you need to run a beautiful old theorem called the Minkowski theorem that says that you can associate to a set of n vectors that close a polyhedron, a convex polyhedron. So we get this picture of a semi-classical grain of space as a polyhedron. And the thing that I think is interesting about this picture is that you can now build quantum mechanical operators in a very simple way. For example, you can build a volume operator as the coherent state quantization of the classical volume of this polyhedron. So this was proposed by Bianchi, Donna, and Speziale, and Pietro Donna is visiting now. So the thing that I want to tell you about is this constructive idea about understanding the quantization of these operators. And it relies heavily on Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. So I'm just going to set conventions and review that very quickly. the idea is that if you have an observable of interest, here I'm taking the Hamiltonian, simple as possible Hamiltonian, just a harmonic oscillator, the quantization of this observable can be achieved by requiring that the action, the classical action of an orbit, is an integer multiple of Planck's constant. So this action has the interpretation in the classical phase space as the area captured by that orbit. And so you're dividing the phase space up into these Planck-sized cells. And that's how you're quantizing this operator. So one thing to say is that immediately these angular momentum operators that are associated to classical angular momenta, you can perform this Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. Angular momenta can be embedded in an oscillator. This is the Schwinger model for angular momentum. And the quantization of area is an exact result because it's a quadratic Hamiltonian. So immediately you have quantization of area in this picture. But in addition, what Eugenio and I showed a couple years ago is that you can associate a classical phase space to a tetrahedron. You just fix the areas of the faces of the tetrahedron. You choose the volume as the classical Hamiltonian, the classical volume of this tetrahedron. And you look for the orbits that satisfy this Planck cell condition. So I've drawn these orbits here. These are the quantized orbits of this volume operator. And in this case, you can solve analytically for the action. And you can find the spectrum of the volume of this tetrahedron. And many of you have seen this result before, but it's a remarkable agreement between the semi-classical Bohr-Sommerfeld values, these dark dots, and the exact numerical diagonalization of the operator in loop gravity. So the main thing that I want to point out here is that this gives a resolution to this problem of divergences. The reason that it does that is that there's a gap. There's a non-zero spacing between the zero eigenvalue and the first volume eigenvalue here. So this has been predicted in loop gravity for a while. This is just a very constructive route to get to this result. But you can do more with the polyhedral picture. For some time, people have been concerned that maybe if you went to a more complicated grain of space with more faces, that this volume gap might not be robust. The eigenvalues of the volume might get squished towards zero, and you wouldn't know that there was a true gap between zero and non-zero volume. So the polyhedral picture allows you to address this question as well. You can analytically solve for the volume of a pentahedron. And in particular, this allows you to completely characterize the phase space, the phase diagram of a pentahedron. So these different regions that are colored differently are the different adjacencies, where if I give you a set of five vectors, you ask me which one ends up being the top face or the bottom face of the pentahedron. This analytic solution allows you to characterize that phase diagram. So another visitor here today, Chris Coleman-Smith and Bernd Mueller, and in separate paper, I studied the classical dynamics associated to this volume operator. And both groups find that it's highly chaotic. And this is an interesting conclusion for the volume spectrum again, now for a very different reason. But that reason is that classically chaotic systems have a very characteristic distribution of spectral spacings. So here I'm plotting. All right, this is borrowed from Bohini, Giannoni, and Schmidt. This is the probability of a given spectral spacing, S. And you see that this curve matches very well some numerical data on an experimental Billiard system. And characteristic of this curve is that at low spectral spacing, you have low probability. So this is called level repulsion. Levels don't tend to come real close to each other in a chaotic system. They tend to repel one another. And this is a very robust result for random matrix models of chaotic systems and semi-classical models of chaotic systems as well. So this provides a new, very robust mechanism for preserving this volume gap when you have more faces. And that mechanism is the chaotic level repulsion of a chaotic classical dynamical system along with the fact that this phase space associated to this pentahedron has a low density of states at low volume. So you don't have a ton of states at low volume, and they're repelled from one another. So this is a robust mechanism for preserving this volume gap. So I think that this provides a very nice picture, a nice constructive picture of the fate of divergences. They're physically cut off, and we can see it this way. So I wanted to give that introduction because I'm going to go in a very different direction, but it's a nice motivation for that direction. There's an outstanding challenge in quantum gravity, and that challenge is how to identify the ground state of a general relativistic or a general covariant theory. How do we understand this ground state? And the idea is to try and coordinate. We have these grains of space, and we're trying to coordinate them in some way such that we get the ground state, but we don't have an energy. It's hard to define energy in general relativity in a super straightforward way. And so we can't just minimize energy to find this ground state. So how are we going to identify it? The idea is to use entanglement. Yeah. So for example, can we identify Minkowski space? A flat standard space for quantum field theory. So these finite grains give you close connection to condensed matter systems now, because we have a lattice with a finite number of degrees of freedom, and we can ask whether we can use tools from condensed matter to identify this ground state. So the outline for the talk is as follows. I'm going to tell you a little bit about entanglement, and in particular the tool that we're most interested in, which is the entanglement spectrum. And then I'm going to give you our result, which is a new result for a spherical region of space. And this is the full details of this entanglement spectrum, and in particular the eigenvectors associated to the eigenvalues. And then I'll end with what I think the interest for quantum gravity is. So how is entanglement being used in condensed matter systems? Since 92, the idea has been, if I pick some physically interesting Hamiltonian, is there some way to provide a nice ansatz for the ground state of that Hamiltonian? And tensor networks give you a nice way of thinking about this. So if I take some general state and expand it in the basis of the Hilbert space, it has a huge number of coefficients. But I can collect those coefficients into a tensor that's contracted with the basis vectors. And the question is, can I take an ansatz for that tensor that's going to help me to identify ground states? And indeed, you can. And a simple ansatz, for example, is that tensor is a contraction of many, many identical tensors. And this is the sort of thing that they use to build up sort of ansatz for ground state. One of the remarkable things that they find is that these ansatz naturally satisfy an area law. So if I take a finite region of my lattice and ask what the entanglement entropy between that finite region and the exterior is, they find that the entanglement entropy goes like the area of that bounding surface. So this is something that we've known for long in gravity, and it's a very interesting property. And the fact that this comes out of the tensor network picture so straightforwardly is very nice. Another reason that tensor networks are very interesting is that the Hilbert space is huge. For an n-body system, let's say n-bodies spins, n-spins, the Hilbert space grows exponentially, 2 to the n. While the physical portion of that Hilbert space that you can access is actually quite small. What do I mean by portion you can access? If I start with the ground state of this interesting Hamiltonian, and I ask that I evolve it in time for only a polynomial time in the number of sites that I have. How much of the Hilbert space can I reach? And the portion that you can reach is exponentially small. So there's only a tiny little corner of this Hilbert space that you can reach in polynomial time starting from ground states. So the identification of an ansatz that picks out that corner that is accessible is very interesting, and tensor networks provide another way to do that. And then of most direct obvious interest to us is that spin networks are examples of tensor networks. So these two tools fit very nicely with each other.
Isn't there an additional idea and its name, which is locality? In the tensor network division, three expressions of locality, we don't have that. So it's not yet these techniques. I mean, they are nice to use because most of them are tensor networks, but you know,
yeah, so in fact, that's one of the ways of saying what we're interested in learning about spin network states is how are we going to talk about local regions. So the rest of the talk is to go to, the idea is to sort of switch perspectives and go to a continuum field theory and understand a finite region in that continuum field theory, and to try and see what we can learn from that finite region about issues of locality and things like that. But yes, this is one of the things we need to learn.
Are you going, maybe to be more precise, that there's two ways in which, you know, there's two notions of locality. In some sense, one could be the number of, let's say, vertices you have between two points, maybe it's the other. The other one could be the amount of spin, and they are very different. Because if it's the amount of spin, then it could be very far away, even if you're just in the network, just goes by. So I think this is the, you know, the tensor network counts locality in terms of being close by, whereas we just, you know, that's what I meant.
Yes.
When you say local region, I guess you're picking one of these two notions of locality.
Yes, and I guess I'm more concerned right now with the notion of nearby and nodes. If I think of the spin as an area, then maybe that doesn't affect how far apart the nodes are, the grains of space. Anyway, so I'll be thinking of this notion of node to node separation. So the tool to think about this continuum field theory is this spherical region. This has been very well studied by Cassini, Huerta, and Myers, and they have a plethora of very nice results, including a detailed study of the entanglement entropy, which also satisfies an area law. So as I said, the thing that we have to add to this picture is a notion of the entanglement eigensystem, the spectrum and the eigenvectors. Okay, so let me tell you about the kind of entanglement that I'm considering. So if we have a Hilbert space, a total Hilbert space, and we divide it into two pieces, and we consider a pure state within that Hilbert space, then we can make a Schmidt decomposition of that pure state. So this is just a generalization of the singular value decomposition. And in particular, we can trace over one of the portions of the Hilbert space and get a reduced density matrix for the other portion. So the quantity that's been studied the most is this entanglement entropy, the von Neumann entropy associated to this reduced density matrix. And what I want to discuss is the fact that that's only a single number, and we'd like a richer characterization of the entanglement of this region. And one way to get that is to think of writing this reduced density matrix as e to the minus h, and we'll call this Hermitian operator the entanglement Hamiltonian. So the Schmidt decomposition that we were just thinking about already provides a diagonalization of this Hamiltonian.
So you're assuming it's invertible?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you know what restriction that is?
So assuming that I can take this log? Yeah, that this is a positive definite.
Well, it's, yeah, more than, it's strictly positive. It's not, there's no zero.
Yes. So this gives rise to this entanglement spectrum, that is the eigenvalues of the entanglement Hamiltonian. So let me just set some boundary conditions for the talk. So I'm going to restrict to the scalar field in D equals 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. And I'm interested in a conformal field theory. This is going to make the calculations possible. And I'll take the metric signature to be the Misner-Thorne and Wheeler one. So despite these restrictions, the results that I have apply for any conformal field theory. This just makes it much simpler to talk about. So let me give you the details of this region. So it's the Cauchy development of a three ball. So a basketball plus its interior is the spatial region. And then we consider the causal diamond associated to that three ball. So in XYZ, it looks like a ball. In the time axis, the ball is this central disk, and then the causal development. And then most frequently, I'll just picture it in the TX plane, where the ball is this interval along the x-axis, and the diamond is the causal development. So in order to study this problem, it's nice to pick a set of coordinates that are adapted to this region of space-time. So in particular, I'm going to pick coordinates that preserve the boundary two-sphere of this ball. So preserve in the same sense that polar coordinates preserve the origin. These coordinates are going to go through the boundary sphere, which in this 2D slice are just the endpoints of this interval. So I'll call these diamond coordinates. And the idea is just to use hyperbolic slices both in the spatial slice and in the time-like slice. And I'll call the coordinate that runs along the spatial slice, it's going to be a radial type coordinate, sigma. So it runs from 0 at the center of the diamond to infinity at the right edge. And the time coordinate will be lambda, and it runs from negative infinity in the past to infinity in the future. And as soon as you require that these are hyperbolic slices, you can solve for what T and R are in terms of these lambda and sigma. And then finally, in the 4D region, which is what I'll always be considering, you can extend with spherical coordinates. So in this coordinate system, the standard Minkowski metric becomes a conformal rescaling of static kappa equals negative 1, that is the negative constant negative curvature FRW universe. So this nice form of the metric in these coordinates is the main tool that I'll use for the results. And while we're here looking at this metric, I just want to point out that the vector d by d lambda is a conformal killing vector of Minkowski spacetime, because it's clearly a killing vector of this FRW metric, and this FRW metric is conformally related. So this is our conformal killing vector. These are conformal. So what I was just telling you was just what this coordinate system looks like within the finite region, within the diamond. So if I really want to coordinatize Minkowski space with this, I need to extend these coordinates outside of that finite region.
Just a question.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
How does it look like?
I haven't done that yet. I'd like to do that. When we were explaining this to Bill Unruh, I think he had deep intuition coming from that that coordinate invariant way of thinking about it. I haven't done it yet, though. So here I'm picturing the conformal completion of Minkowski space. The finite region that I was just telling you about is this central diamond, which I'll call region one. And the idea is to extend these coordinates in a nice way outside to the whole of this conformal diagram. So here I've depicted it in the usual space-time diagram with a T and X plane. Again, here's our region one. And a natural way to continue the coordinates outside of the central diamond region is just to keep following these hyperbolic slices. So you have this nice hyperbolic slicing here, and the time-like slices here. And then you can also continue this less obviously into the regions 3 and 4, and 3 and 5, and 4 and 6. And again, these are just hyperbolic slicings. So one thing that's somewhat unusual about this slicing is that not all of these slices are Cauchy surfaces. Only at lambda equals 0 do you get a Cauchy surface. And for other lambda, because these hyperboli are asymptotically null, you actually hit scry. So you run into the boundary of the space-time. So this means that in order for my conclusions to be true about for any Cauchy slice, I'll often do calculations on the lambda equals 0 slice here. So another aspect of these coordinates, which is nice, is that if you go to the large sigma limit near the right corner of the diamond, you can show that the coordinate transformation I was just describing reduces to precisely the coordinate transformation of a Rindler spacetime. So in the small, right in the vicinity of this entangling surface of the sphere, this coordinate system looks like the slicing of Rindler spacetime. So these spatial slices are generated by the boost Hamiltonian, and the hyperbolic slices are the usual rapidity hyperbolic slices. So I'll use this fact later on. The presence of this conformal killing vector allows us to understand what Hamiltonian generates this foliation that I've been telling you about. So associated with the conformal killing vector is a current. And as long as we're working in a conformal theory, the conformal symmetry guarantees that the stress energy tensor is traceless. And using that traceless condition, you can show that this current is conserved. It's another current. And so the Hamiltonian that generates this flow can be seen as another charge associated with this current. So this is how we build the entanglement Hamiltonian. So I'm jumping ahead telling you it's the entanglement Hamiltonian. For now, it's just the charge that generates this foliation. So a nice thing that goes back to Laurent's question from the reduced density matrix is that using this form, doing the calculation for the scalar field theory, you can show that this Hamiltonian is positive. So we have an explicit form that shows that it's positive. Here I've dropped a boundary term, and that boundary term corresponds to the condition that the field vanishes on the entangling sphere. So this is what makes the density matrix well-defined. Okay, so I gave away the punchline that this is the entanglement Hamiltonian. Let me make that argument for you now. So the intuition is that this generates this nice local flow, and so it should be positive. And so that was the intuition, but it was only after I constructed it that I was able to show explicitly that it was positive. So the idea is to use these Euclidean path integral methods. So to construct them in Minkowski vacuum, for example, you wick rotate to imaginary time, and you do the path integral over the whole half space up to the slice where you want your state with the boundary condition that the action vanishes at infinity. So this gives you the Minkowski vacuum along this axis. And in a very similar way, you can actually build density matrices. So you have boundary conditions on your field just above and just below the axis. And you do the Euclidean path integral with the boundary condition that vanishes at infinity for the whole region. And you get the reduced density matrix that's just on that half slice. So what the nice thing about explicitly having constructed these coordinates is that I can do this path integral explicitly. So when I do this wick rotation, the sinh that was in the numerator becomes a sine, and these become precisely the well-known orthogonal bipolar coordinates. So this is a system of coordinates where you have circles going around two centers, and then circles that go through the two centers. This is an orthogonal coordinate system for the plane. So now I can perform this path integral, and you find explicitly that this is e to the negative 2 pi, this charge. So indeed, C is the entanglement Hamiltonian for this region. Okay. So now what we contributed that I think is the most interesting is we used a sort of inverted strategy. Normally, you try and understand curved space quantum field theory by taking methods you knew in flat space and building them up in your curved background. What we did is we tried to understand the flat space quantum field theory of a finite region by using curved space tools. So I'm going to try and build for you the mode functions of this finite region by using tools from curved space quantum field theory. So here's the Lagrangian of our scalar field in curved space-time in a curved background. So we have a non-trivial metric here. I'm interested in a conformal theory, so I'm going to take the mass to be zero. But I am going to have a coupling to the scalar curvature of the background. And in particular, this coefficient of that coupling is fairly important. The theory is only conformally invariant with this conformal coupling. And I'll be using the conformal symmetry a lot. So that's necessary here. So the action associated to this Lagrangian is conformally invariant, under a conformal transformation of the metric and of the field. So here the notation is I'm going to have the flat space variables have bars on them, and the curved space variables are unbarred. So in particular, the barred metric is just the standard Minkowski metric. So using this Lagrangian and these transformations, you can see how the equations of motion transform, and you find that the equation of motion in flat space is given by this equation of motion in the curved space. So as I was saying, the strategy is that this is hard for me to solve a priori. I don't know how to solve that equation. But the conformally related FRW metric is a static, nice FRW metric, and I can solve this equation, so I can infer the mode functions, the barred mode functions from that solution. Flat space-time wave equation in these diamond coordinates. So it's only complicated because I have this finite region, right? Because I picked out part of the space-time. So here are the solutions. So as I mentioned, when I said that Hamiltonian was positive, We have to require that the field vanishes on the boundary of the region, and that the derivative of the field isn't diverging there, is the additional assumption. It's just not diverging. So here are the solutions. I'm calling these sphere modes. So let me orient you to this diagram. So the sphere modes depend on three quantum numbers, K, J, and M. I've plotted K is a continuous variable, goes from 0 to infinity. J and M are the usual discrete spherical, Y, J, M is the spherical harmonic. So here's plots for fixed value of k equals 4.1. This top row is m equals 0, j equals 0. Then j increases as you go down the diagram, and m increases as you go to the right. So here's j equals 1, m equals 1, and m equals negative 1. So this gives you a very concrete feeling for what these mode functions are. I've plotted these on the lambda equals 0 slice. And I've chosen various theta just so you can see sort of non-trivial behavior in these. If I picked the same theta for all of them, some of them would be flat and boring to look at. So there's a variety of choices of theta here. So these are the sphere modes. So just to actually show you what the result is, again, here's my FRW metric. I separate variables, and you can find the chi, the lambda dependence is very simple. The spherical dependence is the standard one. And the non-trivial part is finding these pi functions. And they're given by this recursion relation on j, k and j. N here is just a normalization that depends on k and j. So the most important thing from this is to remember that this k is a continuous index. So these are the solutions for the FRW, and then I get my sphere modes by a conformal rescaling of those solutions. So explicitly, here are the sphere modes. Okay. So what's the physical picture? I just gave you all of the analytical results, but what's the interesting thing here? Now that I have this complete basis of solutions for the wave equation, I can do what I do in flat space. So I can take a field operator, expand it in this basis of operators, and I can define a vacuum as that state which is annihilated by these annihilation operators in this expansion. So I can do the same thing now. I can ask about the vacuum inside this sphere. So this is a state that's cut out any entanglement between the outside and the inside of the sphere. And in particular, these sphere modes allow me to expand the field in this basis of states and define this vacuum as the state which is annihilated. Both. Absolutely. So one comes back from our conformal diagram. So the one is the central diamond region. Two is the neighboring region that is also spanned by the Cauchy surface that goes through the middle. So I have modes that are inside the sphere, and I have modes that are outside the sphere. And one is the interior, and two is the exterior. The star is just complex conjugation. OK, so to give these particles, these modes, a name, we call them spherons. And these excitations, when I act with this creation operator, these excitations are completely localized within the sphere. We saw this very visually in the last slide, picturing the modes. They're completely contained within the region. And this is achieved by this conformal factor. OK, So now that we have this basis of solutions, we can try and understand what the spectrum of this entanglement Hamiltonian is. So the idea is to introduce the curved space stress energy tensor. But in addition, remember, I wanted to require that it was traceless. And there was a lot of confusion about this in the 70s and 80s about making this tensor traceless. So it's got funny names. It's the new improved stress energy tensor. But the point is that you just add in multiples of the equations of motion. They're kind of hiding here. Remember, the equation of motion was that box phi minus a multiple of the scalar curvature was 0. But if you use that equation of motion, indeed, this stress energy tensor is traceless. No. So this was not something I had appreciated at first. This came out of discussions with Abhay Ashtekar. This does not satisfy any of the standard energy conditions. And that's why it's important that we explicitly checked that our Hamiltonian was positive. Yeah, but this is a mystery for any conformal field theory on curved space-time. So why does this thing exist, and why does it make sense if it doesn't satisfy any of the energy conditions? So, but it's perfectly well-defined and clear in this particular context. Yes, yes. Sorry, I didn't make that clear. Yeah. So again, I'm just restating what the definition of the entanglement Hamiltonian is. And now using these modes, you can do an explicit calculation of what this is on the mode functions. And you find something very simple in the end. The Hamiltonian can be expanded as this is the standard orthogonality, the standard summation for a continuous index and these discrete indices. The value k is essentially our entanglement spectrum, and then we have the number operator for the sphere modes. So this is very much like standard flat space quantum field theory, where we've now found this spectrum. As usual, you have to renormalize, but this has been treated for the FRW case, and it's clear that this renormalization, this is the standard zero-point energy renormalization. It does not. This spectrum does not. Yes. I think it's because it's a conformal field theory that it doesn't. That's an interesting point. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. But it's clear when you do the calculations, the conformal factor cancels out of everything. So the region size, the sphere, the radius of the sphere doesn't come into the calculation at all. So that's worth thinking about more.
So this is the entanglement spectrum, Newtonian vacuum, or in general? How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It must have to do with our choice of boundary conditions. So the evolution can be split up into two parts, and so far I've been concentrating on the reduced density matrix that's associated to the interior of this region. So that's the evolution Cn that I've been telling you about. But of course, the Cauchy slice actually evolves on the exterior of the region as well. And just like in Rindler, where the boost sort of boosts the right slice forward and the left slice down or into the past, here we have an opposite evolution. Cn evolves you towards the future, while Cout brings you down. So you can think of this, the total Hamiltonian, as the difference of two positive operators. And so in general, the entanglement spectrum, it's not the entanglement spectrum anymore, because it's not for the reduced density matrix, but the total spectrum of this Hamiltonian is just the number operator for the modes on the exterior as well. Yeah. Yeah, so good. And I should write that plus boundary term that I have not studied yet. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So the exciting result is that we now have an explicit way, and I'll be careful, as Laurent's pointing out, and just restrict myself to the Cauchy slice where lambda equals zero. We have an explicit decomposition of the Minkowski vacuum into modes within the diamond, restricted completely within the diamond, and modes to its exterior. And we know what this entanglement spectrum is. It's this K of these mode functions. So that's the result. And I'll go into the more speculative part of the talk and tell you about why I think this result is interesting and what it might be able to teach us about quantum gravity. So as I've said already, the idea is that this gives us a nice perspective on spin networks. Spin networks have exactly the same sort of behavior. The basis that we usually work with has no entanglement. The intertwiner at a spin network node has no entanglement between one node and the other. And so we're trying to understand what the right way to superpose spin network states might be to give the entanglement of the Minkowski vacuum. So the individual nodes of a spin network are like the interior of the sphere. They have no entanglement a priori with the other nodes. And the question that we're trying to investigate and hope to understand is whether we can choreograph the entanglement of these intertwiners in such a way as to recover the Minkowski vacuum. And the strategy here is to really rely on what people have been learning about condensed matter systems and see if we can use that. The obvious objection, or at least the obvious objection for me to what I was just saying, is that so far, this continuum example that I was just showing you only tells you about the entanglement between the interior of a single sphere and the exterior. And a spin network is much richer than that. It has multiple nodes. And so this is related to the locality question that Laurent was asking. How do we understand the entanglement between multiple nodes? So another continuum example, which I think would be interesting to investigate, was studied by Cassini and Huerta. What they've done is they've just taken a multi-component region. Instead of taking a single sphere, a single causal diamond, they study multiple diamonds, in fact, n diamonds that are separated from one another. And they've only done this in 1 plus 1 so far. But the entanglement Hamiltonian has a very interesting structure. It's made up of two pieces, a local flow and a non-local piece. But what's wonderful about this explicit example is that they're actually able to study the non-local piece and solve it. What they find is that in general, the non-local piece only couples a single trajectory from one of the regions with a single trajectory from the other region. So I don't understand the physical significance of this yet, but I think it's important for understanding entanglement Hamiltonian and whether we can extract something interesting for quantum gravity, where this issue of locality is very important from these methods. So I think this, the fact that we have an example to start playing with here, is very interesting. Another thing I want to show you is just these plots on the right, which are just for the local flow. And you can see some very nice structure. So the, if the two multi-component regions are separated by a large fraction of their size, then they look basically just like the flows of a single region that I was showing you so far. But as you let them approach one another, so 1/140th of their size, you see that these trajectories start to respond to the nearness of the other region and bend. And unfortunately, this bottom plot you can't see very well. But if you bring them so close, you can see that they've responded in such a way that they continue as if it was a single region of twice the width. So the local flow is very much responding to this separation of these two regions. So this is something that I'd like to understand more in detail. Okay, so now I'm going to switch subjects. Another thing that I think is very interesting coming out of this work is that we can completely solve for this vacuum state that I was telling you about. So we can get the two-point function explicitly. Again, we're using the conformal symmetry in order to do this. And when you have that conformal symmetry, you can relate the two-point function in our diamond region to the two-point function of the FRW space by the conformal factor. So in 1 plus 1, we get this two-point function. And in 3 plus 1, we get this. So they're explicit formulas. So this allows us to make an interesting comparison. So as far as I know, causal sets are the only sort of well-understood Lorentz invariant discretization of space-time. So they have this very nice discretization that they have a handle on. And they've been studying an interesting state within the causal set theory, which is this Sorkin-Johnston vacuum. And the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum is closely related to the sphere vacuum. It's defined only through reference to the interior of the diamond. And in particular, it has no entanglement between the interior of the diamond and the exterior. And so in particular, it doesn't satisfy the Riesch-Leder theorem. Right? In the Riesch-Leder theorem, I have some local region. I act with local operators there, and I can build any global state. Well, the way I build that global state is through entanglement with the exterior. So the fact that this is cut off any entanglement means I can't build that global state. So Afshorty and several other people here have been investigating this Sorkin-Johnston vacuum in 2D. And they find a couple of surprising things. They find that this near the left and right diamond corners, the Sorkin-Johnston two-point function does not act like the Rindler two-point function. It acts like there's boundary conditions that are mirrors. So it's not Lorentz these are not Lorentz invariant boundary conditions. And they're trying to understand what this means. So how does this compare to our sphere vacuum? What happens when we take this limit in our sphere vacuum? We recover these two two-point functions. So this is in the large sigma limit. And so I'm taking both the two points of the two-point function in this large sigma limit. And this is precisely the two-point functions of the Rindler spacetime. So our sphere vacuum does behave like Rindler in this limit. So it's certainly different from the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum in 2D. But the thing that I think is really interesting that we have now is we have this complete basis of sphere modes. So you can go and you can ask what combination of sphere modes are going to build the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum. And you can actually get a detailed handle on what the difference between the sphere vacuum and the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum are. So this is an interesting avenue to pursue from this work. And finally, I just want to make a couple of speculative comments about the Riesz-Leder theorem. So if you take seriously this thing that I began with, that there's a physical cutoff at the Planck scale that regularizes divergences, then what becomes of the Riesz-Leder theorem in this limit? So another way of asking this is, what is the Riesz-Leder theorem in a finite number of degrees of freedom system?
Can you recall the
Riesz-Leder? Yes. So again, Riesz-Leder is the statement that the entanglement of cyclic states like the Minkowski vacuum, nice enough states, is rich enough that by acting with local operators, operators within a fixed domain, you can get arbitrarily close to any global state. So you can use the entanglement tails to build up any state of the field theory. So you get exactly this in a two-state spin system. So let me just show you that real quickly. So if we start with a rich enough entangled state, here I'm just using a EPR state, and we act with ladder operators, raising and lowering operators, we can clearly reach any of the basis states of the two-state system, right, by making a measurement with one of these. So by acting with ladder operators, I can steer one of the spins to any state in its space. I just steer it into the right combination of basis states. So this is Riesz-Leder for a two-spin system. Okay, so it does exist in some discrete systems, but what about if I take a more general example? So what if I take a finite number of degrees of freedom, I split the Hilbert space in two pieces, what's the richest entangled state I can get? Well, it's going to be determined by the dimension of the smaller Hilbert space. That's called the Schmidt rank. It's the number of terms, the maximum number of terms that are going to be independent in this sum is the dimension of the smaller of the two Hilbert spaces. But now it's clear that Riesz-Leder has to fail for this discrete system, because by acting on states in A in the smaller space, I clearly can't steer onto all of the HB Hilbert space, because I only have the dimension of the smaller Hilbert space worth of terms here to steer towards. So Riesz-Leder does not hold in general for general decomposition of a discrete number of degrees of freedom. So the question that I have here is, in what sense, if any, does the Riesz-Leder theorem hold for a large but finite number of degrees of freedom? And how can we build up the Riesz-Leder theorem in the limit? And I think this may be important for sort of sorting out some of the confusion that's happening with entanglement in the context of quantum gravity. So I think that there's an interesting and potentially very fruitful avenue to research here, which is using entanglement to engineer the Minkowski vacuum. Already we see that there's interesting connections with causal sets, and that we have an opportunity to sort of deeply understand the states that are being built, the Sorkin-Johnson state, for example, using sphere modes. And I think the fate of the Riesz-Leder theorem for large but finite number of degrees of freedom may provide a nice insight into issues of cutoff and locality and things like this. So thank you very much for your attention.
Well, that question goes back to the first one, so which is the project of you saying you want to identify one particular state via entanglement. So it could be more precise. I mean, there's an infinite number of states which are going to be entangled. So which one are you going to call the vacua? What's the strategy?
So a generic state of the Hilbert space does not satisfy this area law. So this is clear in many, many condensed matter systems that if you pick just a random vector in the Hilbert space, it doesn't have the right entanglement structure. It has way too much entanglement. The entanglement entropy goes like the volume of the region that you've picked out. So one of the things we do know about Minkowski, for example, very in detail for both Rindler and for the spherical case, is that the entanglement entropy goes like the area. So this would be a first criterion. Can we use entanglement to identify the states in quantum gravity that have the correct area law? And then if that's still a huge number, then we have to look for more.
But so far we have a problem that we have zero entanglement. So states have zero.
Yeah.
So this is also a huge problem. So the area, but there will still be an infinite number of states with the area.
To gauge inlay endpoints or the zero kind of
entanglement? Entanglement in interpliners. Factorized of interpliners.
So yes, I agree. There's still going to be more states, and we're going to have to understand more rich details. So for example, in condensed matter systems, one of the things that's nice is that the entanglement spectrum helps you to distinguish different geometries of the entangling surface. So this has been shown for some of these projected entangled pair states. So it's part of why I think we need to understand in more detail this continuum to discrete transition, because in this entanglement spectrum that I was just showing you, I don't see any structure telling me that I have a spherical geometry here. But in the discrete cases of condensed matter systems, you do have information in the entanglement spectrum that's telling you about the geometry of your entangling surface. So I'm very curious to see if we can get a handle on the geometry of the entangling surface in addition, and this might help us to further winnow down these perspective states. I'm giving you global perspectives. I'm very much at the beginning stages of trying to achieve the things that I'm saying here. But I think it's a nice first step that we have this very explicit result.
There are no more questions, then maybe we can continue the discussion over some cookies and let's thank our speaker again.